You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. It was a crisp spring evening in Stockholm, 1932. A sparsely furnished apartment in the inner city neighborhood of Atlas was engulfed in silence. Light from the bathroom illuminated most of the home in a dusky glow. The phone rang and rang, relentless, through the ominous silence. But no one answered. A couple of nights before, Lily Lindstrom had invited some neighbors around to listen to a special radio broadcast for Wall Purchase Night, an annual spring celebration. The Jonssons arrived at 9:30, but Lily wasn't home. They thought she had changed her plans and gone out for the night. Somewhat confused, they returned to their apartment. Another neighbor, Lily's friend Mimi, was running late and only arrived around 9:45. She capered upstairs to Lily's first floor apartment and tried to open the door as she assumed everyone was already inside listening to the radio. But the door was locked and everything seemed quiet inside. Mimi thought she had misunderstood the invitation and decided to go out to join in the city's Wall Purchase Night celebrations. Mimi hoped she might run into Lily at the bonfire, but she didn't see her anywhere that night. Over the next couple days, Lily was nowhere to be seen. Her phone kept ringing and ringing, cutting through the haunting silence of her apartment. On the living room floor was a dried-up pool of blood, and Lily's lifeless body lay face down on the daybed of her living room. What happened to Lily Lindstrom on Wall Purchase Night in 1932? Lily Elizabeth Larsson was born on August 29, 1900, in Malmö, Sweden. Her parents were Franz and Tilda Larsson, and Lily was the eldest of 10 children. Lily was the eldest by 4 years. Then her 9 brothers and sisters followed, with her youngest sibling being born when Lily was 22. Lily was always a happy and peaceful person. She married a merchant called Lindstrom when she was in her late teens, but the marriage didn't last. The couple didn't have any children, and Lily decided to start over in the larger city of Stockholm. She was only 22 years old, and she hoped that the post-World War I optimism of the time would mean she'd have a bright future. Because Sweden was neutral during the war, the historic charm of their cities was preserved. At the time, many people left the Swedish countryside for cities as industries were booming. Stockholm was a busy city with cars, trams, and horse-drawn carts bustling through the streets. It was the Roaring Twenties. People loved going out and socializing. Bars and restaurants were thriving. But a decade later, things changed, due to the collapse of Wall Street and the Great Depression. Unemployment rose to 25%, and those who still had jobs struggled to make ends meet. One of those was the upbeat girl from Malmö, Lily Lindstrom. At the beginning of April 1931, she set herself up in an apartment on Sankt Eriksplan, in the neighborhood of Atlas. Atlas was not the safest neighborhood and became known for the seedy activities of its residents and petty crimes. Like most of the inner city districts, Atlas was cold and unforgiving during the long winter months. It was through her friend Emma that Lily got to know the building at 11 Sankt Eriksplan, as she lived there with her husband. In 1932, Lily was 32 years old and single and lived in a sparsely furnished apartment. She watched how she spent her money, but occasionally splurged on something extravagant, like a telephone. At the time, it was not common for people to have personal phones in their homes, but Lily had one. She also purchased a radio, and it became the entertainment of all her neighbors. Lily bought new clothes on account at big clothing retailers and paid off her debts. It was important for Lily to mind her appearance, as it was better for business. You see, to pay the bills, she resorted to the oldest profession in the world, that of a sex worker. Because this line of work was illegal, she popped on a police's radar from time to time. They knew who she was and what she did for a living. She may have even committed petty crimes too, as police had her fingerprints on file. Atlas, where Lily lived, is known as Vasastaden today. It's a 1.2-mile radius district in central Stockholm. At the center of the neighborhood is Sankt Eriksplan. In 1932, it was also a subtle spot where sex workers met their clients. Lily did not wait outside in the cold to meet clients, because she had a telephone in her apartment. Clients called her. She was the only one in the entire building with a phone, something that gave her the multi-layered nickname of Call Girl. For the most part, men called Lily to make appointments, and she was careful about whom she let into her apartment. On occasion, when she did meet someone on the street or in a restaurant for the first time, she made sure to enter her apartment ahead of them. She made a habit of removing the phone number, written on a piece of paper in the center of the dial on the phone, if she was with an unknown client. This was a precaution. She didn't want them to see it and take her number down. Lily only gave her phone number to regular clients, people in whom she trusted. Well, mostly. In the apartment block at 11 Sankt Eriksplan, there lived two other women who were sex workers, and their clients used Lily's phone too. One of them was a 21-year-old woman, born and bred in Stockholm. Then, downstairs from Lily, was a 35-year-old woman from the north, Mimi Jensen. Between the three of them, the phone number, Vasa 10422, was used often. On Saturday, April 30th, 1932, it was Walpurgis Night. This is an annual holiday celebrated in Germany, Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, and the Czech Republic, honoring Saint Walpurga. This saint was always said to protect people against pests, rabies, whooping cough, and witchcraft. But in later times, the festival's focus moved towards a celebration of light, ushering in spring, celebrating the end of Sweden's unforgiving winter. On Walpurgis Night in Stockholm in the 1930s, bonfires in Djurgården lit up the early spring night sky, with dead branches people dragged out from the woods. Everyone sang traditional songs while alcohol flowed freely. The highlight of the evening was to be a fireworks display. On the afternoon of Walpurgis Night, Lily Lindström dropped by the apartment of her landlady, Ruth Jonsson, to pay her rent, in advance for the month of May. Ruth invited the cheerful as usual Lily in for a cup of coffee. Then they left together to buy some flowers. Lily asked Ruth and her husband to come over that evening at 9:30 to listen to a special radio broadcast for Walpurgis Night. Lily had recently bought a new radio, and she was looking forward to listening to the variety show that was planned. Ruth said she'd see her later, and the friends parted ways. Lily called at another neighbor, her friend Emma Lundgren. Emma and Lily had known each other for 6 years before Lily moved into Sankt Eriksplan in April of 1931. Living in the same building, they saw each other almost every day. On the afternoon of Walpurgis Night 1932, Emma was on her way to go shopping when Lily showed up. She asked her to go along, and Lily happily agreed. When they returned, Emma went to Lily's apartment for a cup of coffee and left shortly after 6 p.m. Lily was still cleaning up the coffee cups when Mimi Jensen from downstairs knocked on the door. The two of them hung out and talked about their plans for later that night. After the Walpurgis Night's radio broadcast, they planned to go to the bonfire in Djurgården. The ladies oohed and aahed about what they were going to wear, what they'd do with their hair, who they hoped to bump into at the fair. Then, Lily's phone rang. It was about 6:30 p.m. On the other end of the line was a man. Mimi sat close by and Lily held the receiver so she could hear the conversation. Lily was slightly confused as to how the man knew her number and said, "But I don't know you." He did not explain and asked Lily if she was free. The man was nearby, so Lily was expecting him soon. Mimi later recalled the entire conversation. It went something like this. The man asked, "Is this Miss Lindström?" Lily said, "Yes, it is." Then he said, "Are you home for a visit?" Lily laughed. "Of course I am, as you can hear. Are you able to see me? if I come for a while? The man asked. Lily, yes, are you far away? The man, no, I'm really close. I'll be right over. Lily did not have to explain to Mimi, who took the cue and left her friend to her business. When she left, Mimi went to a shop in Sankt Eriksblan to collect milk she had ordered. Then she went straight home to her own apartment downstairs from Lily's. It wasn't long before she heard a knock on her door. It was Lily asking if she could borrow a condom. This was not unusual between the two sex workers. It was a way of checking in. Mimi gave her one condom and Lily went back upstairs, but within minutes, she returned. This time, she was wearing nothing but an overcoat and boots, asking again for a condom. Mimi thought it was strange, but seeing as though this was how they signaled each other, everything was okay. She complied and gave her a couple of condoms. Mimi saw Lily going up the stairs, humming cheerfully to herself. She seemed happy and upbeat, about to earn some money before spending the evening with her friends. This was about 7:15 p.m., and Mimi closed the door and started titivating for the night out. At 9:45 p.m., Mimi made her way up the stairs to Lily's place. She was running a bit late for the radio broadcast, but then again, she wasn't really interested in that. Mimi quietly hoped the show was almost finished, so that they can go to the bonfire at Djurgården. Lily's door was locked, and when Mimi knocked, there was no answer. It was quiet inside, so Mimi assumed Lily had gone ahead to Djurgården with her client. When Mimi arrived at the bonfire, she could not find her friend anywhere. She didn't know what Lily's client looked like. She never saw him when he arrived, but she kept an eye out for Lily. When Mimi returned home, she went to check on Lily, but again, no one was there. There was also no sign of Lily the next day, and most of her neighbors assumed that she had perhaps taken off with the client. It had happened in the past, but typically Lily would mention something before she left. A couple of days passed, with the ringing phone in Lily's apartment going unanswered. A male friend of Lily's failed to get a hold of her on the phone all week. On Wednesday, the 4th of May, he went to her apartment to check on her. He spoke to Mimi and asked if she knew where Lily was. By this time, Mimi was deeply concerned, and together they went to Ruth Janssen and her husband, the landlords of the building. Ruth said that they went to Lily's place on Walpurgis night, but she wasn't there. In fact, they called her from another location to tell her that they were on their way, but she didn't answer the phone. When they arrived at 9:30, as was arranged a couple of hours before, there was no sign of Lily. They assumed she had forgotten about their planned visit and left it at that. It bothered Ruth, though. She found it unusual seeing as Lily never forgot things like that. And if her plans changed, she would always let them know. From the street, on Walpurgis night, Ruth and her husband saw that Lily's windows were closed, the blinds were rolled up, and the lights were off. Something wasn't right. Together, Ruth, Mimi, and Lily's friend went to another neighbor, Lily's friend of 6 years, Emma Lundgren, who said the last time she saw Lily, like the others, was early in the afternoon on Walpurgis night when they went shopping and had coffee. Lily did not mention that she was going to see anyone that night. After that, she never saw her and only heard her phone ringing, but no one ever answering. They made plans to meet up again on Monday, May 2nd, but Lily never showed up. The group decided it was time to inform the police. Ruth Janssen went to the nearest police station at Halsingatan and reported her concerns. An hour later, a constable showed up at 11 Sankt Eriksblan. Officer Nordstrom was shown upstairs by Lily's concerned friends. He knocked on her front door and waited. There was no answer. Then he peeped through the mailbox opening in the door and noticed that the bathroom light was on, but no one answered when he called out. Nordstrom left to go and call for a firefighter to help him break down the door. Together, they forced their way into Lily's apartment, and that's when they found her body, face down on the daybed in her lounge. Lily's head was covered in dried blood. Three cushions had been stacked on top of her back, and the bed beneath her had been made. The constable realized that this was not merely a missing persons case and called the station to send homicide detectives. Legendary police chief Alvar Zetterquist himself arrived at the scene. He took one look and knew that there was vital evidence that could help them solve the crime. It was a time before forensic investigators as such, but Zetterquist understood the value of having a medical examiner at the scene. He summoned Dr. Turnell, the police district physician, to Sankt Eriksplan. The doctor concluded that Lily had been dead for a couple of days. His first opinion was that she was most likely killed on the prior Saturday, Walpurgis night. The scene in Lily's apartment was a strange one. It was a small, sparsely furnished, but cozy space with a kitchenette, a small living room, a separate bedroom, and a bathroom. There were no signs of a struggle anywhere in the apartment. On the contrary, the entire place was spotless. Only one thing seemed out of place, a blood-soaked tea towel in the kitchenette. Lily was lying face down on a daybed in the living room. She was naked but wore socks and long black boots. Her clothes were neatly folded on a chair next to the bed. She lay on her left side, with her head resting on her left arm, and the entire right side of her head was crushed from the temple down to her neck. A used condom was found between her legs, protruding from her buttocks. Some blood had flowed from the daybed onto the floor. By the time police discovered Lily's body, the pool of blood had dried. Lily was attacked from behind, and the blows to her head were so severe, it would have killed her instantly. Lily's friends were able to account for all of Lily's belongings in her apartment. Nothing was missing, so she was not killed with something she owned. Police concluded that the killer brought the murder weapon and took it with him when he left. Mimi told police about Lily borrowing condoms on Walpurgis night. The one between Lily's legs was the only one that was found in her apartment. The killer must have taken the rest with him. Mimi noticed something strange. Lily's number was removed from the phone dial like she usually did when she had a new customer. However, if she was with the man who had called at 6:30 p.m., why would she hide her number? He already had it. Unless, perhaps, a second man paid her a visit. From the start, it was evident that robbery was not the motive. In the apartment, police found Lily's handbag with 22 kroner inside. It also contained her savings book with another 10 kroner, and proof that she had close to 1,000 kroner in the bank. In a chest of drawers in Lily's bedroom, there was a small amount of cash, about 6 kroner. All of the money was untouched. The average wage for women working in Stockholm's industrial workforce at the time was about 2,000 kroner a year. Lily had already paid her rent for May, so her financial position was quite good. Yet, the killer was not interested in her money. Officers processed the scene till late into the night. Just after midnight, her body was carried out of her home and taken to the morgue. Lily's body was returned to her hometown of Malmö, where she was buried on the 16th of May at Malmö Östra Cemetery, Rosengård. An autopsy revealed that Lily had been dead for 2 to 3 days, which meant Mimi was probably the last one, before her killer, to have seen Lily alive. She had 3 blows to her head, caused by a blunt object, like a crowbar or a pipe, which caused her death. Her body had been mostly drained from blood. Saliva was found on Lily's neck and body. In today's time, forensic experts would have had a field day with DNA left at the scene. But this was 1932, so other than collecting samples and taking fingerprints and investigating witness statements, there was not much more investigators could do. Police had hoped that the perpetrator would have an attack of conscience and come forward to confess. But nothing happened. Investigators questioned Lily's friends about her movements on her last day alive. They learned that Lily paid a visit to the landlady, Ruth Jonsson, to pay her rent for May. Ruth said that Lily was her usual self, and they had a short conversation about everyday things like the weather. Lily did not seem concerned or stressed in the least. She was her cheerful self. This was the last time that Ruth saw Lily. She knew Lily slept most of the day and often had company at night, and was used to turning a blind eye, as prostitution was legal in Sweden. So when she didn't see Lily during the days that followed, she wasn't overly concerned. Mimi said that when she was with Lily, the phone call came in at 6:30 p.m. She had leaned into the receiver to listen when Lily spoke to the man who called, and he seemed polite. Mimi described him as a nice, sober gentleman. Nothing was foreboding about the call. Mimi also mentioned that Lily was never afraid of anyone or anything. There was no one in her life that she feared would harm her. A waitress at the Cafe Norma's, located on the ground floor of the apartment block at 11 St. Eric's Blanc, said that a man came into the restaurant at 9 p.m. on Walpurgis night. He ordered 2 steak dinners. She remembered this because she recognized the porcelain container he brought. It was the same as Lily always used. It was interesting that around 9:30 p.m., when Ruth and her husband showed up at Lily's place, Ruth went outside to the street and noticed that the blinds in Lily's apartment were up and that the lights were off. Yet when Officer Nordstrom entered the apartment on Wednesday night, the bathroom light was on. Was it possible that the killer was still in the apartment with Lily when her neighbors knocked on her door? It's not impossible. A local newspaper reported on a mysterious burglary which occurred early in the morning after the murder in the apartment next door to Lily's. At 5 a.m., a woman who lived alone heard movement in her room. She saw a young man leaning over her desk and fiddling with the lock of a storage closet. The woman was startled. She jumped up and screamed. The burglar grabbed her and tried to muffle her screams by placing his hand over her mouth. The woman managed to tear herself loose and ran down the stairs. She then opened the window to St. Eric's Blanc and called out. A patrolling police officer heard her cries and ran over to her. By the time they made their way back to her apartment, the thief was nowhere to be found. Lily's neighbor described the intruder as a very young man, possibly in his late teens. He was wearing a suit, but without a hat or coat, which meant he probably came from somewhere inside the building. Police could not find any signs of forced entry and had no idea where the man had come from or how he escaped. Could it be possible that this man was Lily's killer? When the woman ran out, did he slip back into Lily's apartment where she was lying murdered on the daybed? Because the man was robbing the neighbor, apparently looking for money, police felt that there was no connection to Lily's killer, who did not take any of her cash or belongings. Police had absolutely no idea who Lily's elusive killer could be. They went through her address book and were able to cross people off their suspect list, one after the other. Fingerprints were taken at the scene, but with so many prints not accounted for, it was impossible to find the killer this way. Lily was not the first sex worker to be killed in St. Eric's Blanc, nor was she the last. But her murder was different from others. She was killed inside of her home, and she had records of her clients. This wasn't a random street killing. From the onset, there was a lengthy list of suspects. Lily was organized. She had some bills and receipts in a box. Nothing seemed strange or raised any questions. In a bowl in her apartment, police found business cards of 80 men, all considered to be clients of Lily's. Among her documents was a letter from a man that sparked investigators' interest. They felt it would be a good idea to talk to him, as details in the letter alluded to the fact that he was in a romantic relationship with Lily. However, the sender's address on the letter did not exist, and they could not track him down. They thought that he had used an alias and a false address, perhaps because he was married or held a respectable job and didn't want to be caught out having an affair with a sex worker. Eventually, investigators honed in on 9 men, as they were said to be Lily's most frequent clients. Because of the sensitive nature of Lily's profession, only a few of the men's names were ever made public. The first arrest was made on Thursday, May 5th, the day after her body was found. A man called Ragnar Nilsson was a person of interest, seeing as he had an on-again, off-again relationship with her, even living with her at times. Zetterquist said to the press that he was not a suspect. The man has been that of Mrs. Lindstrom's acquaintance, with whom she was most in contact, and we are only there to get from him the most reliable information about the victim's other acquaintances and her habits, and other information which may be of importance to the investigation. A witness, only named as a drunken woman with the same profession as Lily, came forward and told police that she suspected her husband had something to do with the Atlas murder. Her husband, a pimp and a hustler called Pedersen, came home on the night of Lily's murder with blood on his clothes. It looked like he had tried to clean himself up, but didn't manage to get the bloodstains off. Pedersen was not a stranger to police, so they took him in for questioning. A shady business partner offered a weak alibi, and it looked like he could possibly have been involved. Pettersson denied any involvement, and with no evidence other than his wife's statement, they let him go after 10 days in custody. A couple of days after Lily's body was discovered, Ruth Jonsson received a telegram sent from Copenhagen from another one of Lily's male acquaintances. The man came from Stockholm and worked as a waiter. He had sent a telegram to inquire about Lily's murder. Police managed to find the man's brothers, who both worked as waiters at a local restaurant, and took them in for questioning. It seemed that Lily and this man had an interesting relationship. She was quite vocal about being madly in love with him whenever she had something to drink. When Lily sobered up, she often expressed her disgust of him. Then she drank again, romantic sparks began to fly, and she made every effort to go out and look for him. Police wanted to know if the man was in Stockholm on Walpurgis night, and asked his brothers what he was up to. His brothers both said that they were all together, playing card games with two female friends. Mimi said that she knew the waiter, and Lily often spoke about him. She knew it wasn't the waiter who had called Lily on Walpurgis night, as she had listened to the conversation. Also, Lily was so infatuated with the waiter, if he had wanted to see her that night, Lily would have canceled plans with Mimi and the neighbors so she could spend the whole night with him. Police brought the waiter in and questioned him too. After his alibi was verified by his brothers and the two female friends, he was ruled out as a suspect. 6 weeks after Lily's murder, on the street outside her apartment building, police found a discarded ladle with dried blood on it. It was a puzzling piece of evidence. It was definitely too light to have caused the fatal wounds on Lily's head. For some unexplained reason, a theory was formed that the killer had watched Lily bleed out, then scooped her blood with the ladle and drank it. Also, there was saliva found on her neck. Could the murderer actually have been a real-life vampire? The vampire theory was leaked to an often-blotted reporter who made the information public using the headline, "Vampire Murder in the Atlas Area." Bear in mind, Germany's infamous serial killer Peter Curtin, also known as the Vampire of Dusseldorf, was executed in July 1931, months before Lily's murder. In that same year, Todd Browning's film Dracula was released.
This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Lily's killer made his escape, like Dracula. Perhaps he too flew off into the night in the form of a vampire bat without anyone taking notice. In later years, this theory has been brought into question by many armchair detectives and experts. Renowned Swedish criminologist and author Leif G.W. Pearson said in a 2012 documentary that he felt it is unlikely the ladle had anything to do with the murder. Firstly, as a murder weapon, it was too light. Secondly, how did they know it was blood on the ladle and not simply sauce? Remember, on the ground floor of Lily's apartment building was a restaurant. Chances are that the gravy ladle came from their kitchen. Lily Lindström was immortalized by the name on her police file, Skånska Lily. Her murder was forever sensationalized as the Atlas Vampire Murder. A popular theory is that the killer could have been a police officer who knew how police investigated crime scenes. He staged the bizarre scene, hoping to throw his colleagues off his trail. The blunt instrument that was used to kill her could possibly have been a police baton. Lily's on-again, off-again boyfriend, Ragnar Nilsson, was ruled out by investigators, but the fact that he worked as a servant made some speculators wonder if this is why the murder scene was so tidy. Also, if he lived with Lily from time to time, he would know the movements in the building and would have been able to make an inconspicuous escape. Question is, though, who was the man in Lily's apartment on Walpurgis night? If investigators could only answer that. Murdering sex workers is not uncommon. It wasn't then, and it isn't now. If a client has some psychological issues, a sex worker is at the most vulnerable to fall victim to a moment of rage or a psychotic break. The condom found between Lily's legs protruded from her anus, and she was found face down. It was likely that Lily was struck on the head while her killer was having sex with her. There's a sexual myth called a donkey punch. This is when a man hits his partner on the head or on the back just before he climaxes, hoping that the anus or vagina will contract and cause an enhanced orgasm. No such reflex exists, so don't try this one at home. Also, back in the day, there would not have been a term for it, but perhaps Lily's death was the result of a rough sexual act gone wrong. With someone, a nice and sober gentleman as Mimi called him, who was battling some severe internal demons. The fact that Lily returned for a second condom is significant. Why did she need a second one? Was there a second client? Lily's landlady, Ruth, said that she had witnessed on one night no less than 5 separate men enter Lily's apartment, one after the other, in a matter of 2 hours. Is it possible that the last man with Lily on the night of her murder was not the same man who had called her on the phone? Someone waiting outside the door, maybe, causing her to dart down to Mimi and ask for another condom. It could well have been a second man. Or did something go wrong with the nice and sober gentleman? Did the condom break? Perhaps he suffered from premature ejaculation. Maybe Lily laughed and told him to come back another time, causing him to attack her, killing her. Ashamed of his actions, he cleaned up the scene to avoid any detection. Of course, all of this is speculation. With a historic case like this, it's best to leave it to the professionals. In the 2012 documentary about Lily's case, Leif G.W. Pearson agreed that looking at the crime scene alone, if the murder had been committed in modern times, DNA would have solved it. Sadly, in 1932, investigators had no idea how to preserve evidence for future DNA testing. Pearson also believed that the red spots on the soup ladle were probably not bloodstains after all, and that this element of the investigation had become more and more sensationalized over the years. Many sources embellished the truth by stating that the ladle was found inside the apartment. It was only discovered 6 weeks later in the street outside of her apartment building. Pearson reckons Lily's death is not the big mystery that everyone wants it to be. It is still a tragedy, yes. But it is also a case of a sex worker who was killed while she was working. However, Pearson feels that the ferocity of the attack indicates that there was something more between Lily and her killer. Something caused him to snap. But was he fighting his own issues? Or did he have a motive to kill Lily specifically? Jealousy, perhaps? Or anger? Actual evidence from the scene and a floor plan of Lily's apartment are on display at Stockholm's Police Museum. There is a sample of Lily's brown hair, the saliva sample from her neck, as well as the 3 1932 condom wrappers. Who knows? Perhaps in future, they would be able to get a usable DNA sample from the evidence and finally be able to answer one of Stockholm's most haunting mysteries. Who killed Lily Lindström? If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.